Welcome back to What in the World. My name is Ryan Rosenthal, joined as always by my co-host, Andre Ganuela. And Andre, a lot has happened this week in the world, but let's start where we started off last week with the quad. So how'd it go?
So the quad went pretty well. In my view, it is Biden's aspirant alliance of democracies, in my view. I mean, Joe Biden has often talked about perhaps creating an alliance of democracies and dealing with many global issues in a multilateral sense by working with democracies. And the Quad, as I've said last week, is composed of four democracies, four of the main democracies in the Indo-Pacific. Well, of course, the U.S. isn't in the Indo-Pacific, but it's very much involved. But Japan, India, and Australia are all in that general region. So certainly the multilateral approach is a departure from, you know, his predecessor, Donald Trump, who was often geared towards more of a unilateral stance, very much, you know, America first, which it's sometimes, you know, we'd find ourselves as America alone in some regards. And yeah, and I mean, you know, you're really seeing this pivot to Asia, especially with the rise of China. Because first of all, our traditional European allies, who we counted on against the Soviet Union, who we've counted on traditionally against Russia, aren't so keen to take on China head on. They are not so keen, one, because China has so many economic ties with many of these European countries, for example, Germany, for example, France. And I mean, China to Europe is not the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was right on Europe's border. I mean, the Soviet Union was partially in Europe, in Eurasia. China does not really pose a huge security threat in the immediate future for Europe. And Europe simply does not want to find itself in this bipolar world. So, I mean, as I said last week, the Quad really sort of built in the aftermath of the 2004 tsunami in the Indian Ocean, was resurrected just a few years ago in the face of a rising China. And this meeting was very, very significant because it was the first time that all four leaders of the countries met as part of this Quad arrangement. So that's pretty important. And it looks like it's going to underlie Biden's sort of multilateral strategy with regards to China. A couple of key things came out of this meeting. First, the four countries promised to provide 1 billion COVID-19 vaccines to Asia by 2022. Certainly, this is a move to enhance America's and, you know, their colleagues' soft power, because one, as we've mentioned in other episodes, China has really been practicing this idea of vaccine diplomacy, building and manufacturing and sending these vaccines to countries in the global south. Many countries, perhaps, who might be in debt to China, they're sort of fixing its own image with those countries. So this is, you know, the Western way, not the Western way, but the U.S. way to sort of build up that soft power and counter that vaccine diplomacy with some vaccine diplomacy of its own. Additionally, there was an agreement to come together for a rare earth metals procurement chain that, of course, would also undermine China's dominance in the market. And you should take a look at the joint statement that was released by all four countries. Or you can find it on the White House's website. All four countries express their willingness and need to ensure that there is a free and an open Indo-Pacific. And they talk about, you know, all of these things they're working on, but they never explicitly state China. They do not state China explicitly. All four countries have seen their relationships with China sort of go downhill in the past year. But the sound of the statement, the tone of the statement is very implicit in basically saying the Quad is here to ensure the Indo-Pacific is free and open, implicitly against China. Counter-Chinese assertion in the region.
Yeah, I think the joint statement issued by these four countries is an important one. It's something we mentioned last week as what we should look for as far as where cooperation stands, right? And you don't see anything about defense, and that's important, right? This is not an Asian NATO. There's no Article 5 mutual defense pact here. And so, I mean,
But the idea of the Asian NATO is ever present,
yes,
though.
Like, oh, yeah.
China wants to accuse these four countries of being an Asian NATO. And like, yes, like there wasn't any defense stuff really in the joint statement, but there were the Malabar exercises, I believe last year, that were attended by all four countries, military training exercises. So that aspect is still there.
Right. Yeah, no, and outside of the actual Quad, but between the heads of state, we had U.S. Secretary of State Blinken and Secretary of Defense Austin go to many of these countries as well. And so the U.S. pushed Japan to spend more in defense. It told South Korea, which is not a part of the Quad, but still an important ally of the United States, is in the region, to kind of increase relations in the region with their neighbors, notably South Korea and Japan, have historical issues, you know, a lot of kind of contention between these two countries. And so that presents challenges to regional cooperation.
Definitely. And I did a little op-ed on Medium about the Quad. And one of the papers I was actually looking at came from the Carnegie Endowment by Evan Feigenbaum and James Schwemlein. And they sort of talk about the idea of, the idea that the Quad cannot simply fall into this trap of China, of it just being against China. Because if you're just going to be an anti-China alliance of sorts, and I say alliance because I think it might be an aspirant alliance. Many people may see it as an alliance that aspires to be. Many countries in the Indo-Pacific and Southeast Asia may not necessarily be enticed by, aligning itself with those countries if they are against China, because they have their own ties with China. But rather, these two authors from Carnegie assert that perhaps the Quad needs to build a quote-unquote regional architecture to address non-China problems facing these smaller states. I think the vaccine diplomacy that the Quad is starting to practice is one of those ways. And I think it's really going to be at the core of the Biden administration's multilateral foreign policy with regards to the Indo-Pacific. And whether or not it takes the shape of the Quad, or it takes the shape of bilateral or trilateral relationships with these Quad member countries, I think it's going to be huge.
I think that's something very interesting to think about, because it's unlike NATO, right? This is not a defense first initiative. And just like the EU, that was economic first. And so if they look at other areas of cooperation, that could possibly down the road lead to defense. And so I think that the Quad's not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, it's back. It's here to stay, I think, especially if you're having all the leaders meet. So
yeah, absolutely. All right. So you mentioned Carnegie, and that got me thinking about Bill Burns, who led Carnegie until he resigned, and he is now the CIA director. And so Bill Burns, of course, is not a career CIA official. He was a career State Department official, a career diplomat, served under many, many presidents, high-ranking positions, including the deputy secretary position. If Hillary Clinton had won, he was likely going to be tapped as Secretary of State. But he is now, of course, going to lead the CIA. And so it's very interesting to have him there, right? Yes. Well, you had Ted Cruz holding up a little bit.
I mean, not like it's unexpected for Ted Cruz to hold up anything. I mean,
right. I just think that having Bill Burns there is a very interesting pick, right? Because you want kind of an outsider, just because of kind of the issues that CIA has had over the years, particularly when you're looking at, interrogation and rendition and all the other things that we hear about in the news. And so having a more friendly based at CIA, not someone who was kind of implicated in some of these issues.
Controversial.
Right. is kind of, I guess, a step in the right direction as far as the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And as far as other individuals, it's hard to say that Bill Burns isn't qualified.
Yeah. So, I mean, it'll be very interesting to see where Bill Burns actually takes this. And I mean, he was introduced, actually, at his confirmation hearings by James Baker, who was President Bush 41's Secretary of State. And he was also introduced by Leon Panetta, the former CIA director under the Obama administration and Secretary of Defense. So clearly a lot of bipartisan support for Bill Burns, because I think everyone recognizes that he is a very qualified man to do the job.
And I think something big on his plate will be Iran, something he worked on in the Obama administration very closely. So we'll see where that goes. All right, let's move to Ethiopia next. So President Biden is sending Senator Chris Coons to Ethiopia to relay his concern with the situation in the Tigray region. We've talked about the Tigray region in many of these episodes, including What in the World. We had a full episode with Professor Terrence Lyons on it, talking about the kind of the the internal conflict between the Tigray region government and the government of Ethiopia. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has kind of clamped down on the region, who is kind of, you know, looking to kind of act in opposition to the central government. And so there have been violent clashes. They've basically shut down the areas around the region. Many people have died and been displaced. And so this is one of the first kind of efforts by the Biden administration to kind of take up some of these important humanitarian issues.
Yeah, it's going to be very important. Also, like, it's a clear signal that Biden's taking this issue very seriously. He didn't just send any senator. He sent Chris Coons. I believe Chris Coons, who currently holds Biden's old Senate seat in Delaware and is one of Biden's staunchest allies, was one of his strongest allies during the election. So it's very clear that there is a big concern in the U.S. of the humanitarian crisis and some of these, frankly, massacres that have occurred in the Tigray region. But we will see what happens and how much the U.S. will be involved diplomatically.
Absolutely. All right, Andre, before we kind of get into some other issues, I want to give you my weekly Russia update, if that's okay. All right. So President Biden recently, when talking about Vladimir Putin, he's called him a quote-unquote killer in an interview, and this made President Putin quite upset. And so he recalled Russia's ambassador in Washington, Anatoly Antonov, back for consultations, talking about the issues between U.S. and Russia as far as relations go, and what the relationship kind of looks like under the new U.S. president, President Biden. And so it'll be interesting, you know, not starting off on a very nice note, I guess. But of course, you know, it's very valid to call Vladimir Putin a killer. He certainly is one. And he kind of, interesting enough, Vladimir Putin said right back at you, buddy, to Joe Biden, well, which is quite an interesting thing to say. But Russian social media is really eating all of this up. Russian media is eating it all up. And so it seems like U.S.-Russia relations are not going in a positive direction at the moment, but I don't imagine that these off-the-cuff comments are really going to do substantive damage.
Yeah, and I mean, this is certainly a direct contrast with what Donald Trump said, I think, in 2015 or 2016, when they asked him actually to describe Vladimir Putin as a killer, and Trump replied, quote, "There are a lot of killers. Do you think our country is so innocent?" So I think Joe Biden saying, yeah, he's a killer to Putin is very clearly sort of signaling that, hey, America is not necessarily going to sit back and let Russia do all of this nonsense all over the place. Also, remember, Joe Biden is the guy who, as vice president, actually met with Putin several times. And I think during one of his meetings in 2015, looked into Putin's eyes and said, "You have no soul." I think he told Putin that directly. So it's not like the guys are like friends or anything. Like, they know each other, they know each other well, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with the U.S.-Russian relations, especially with Russia recalling its ambassador upon those comments. Obviously more of a symbolic
right
thing, because I mean, like, what's that really going to do? You're sending a new ambassador, that guy just lost his job.
Well, it's still frosty in Moscow, and relations with the EU are not great either. And so it's very interesting that things are kind of changing for Russia. We have these sanctions because of Navalny. It's just, I don't anticipate things to go better. There was this talk of, you know, will there be a reset? Will we likely see cooperation? And at the present time, the answer is no.
Yeah, that's true. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But moving away from, well, actually, before we get back to Russia, I saw a photo of Navalny recently, I think in prison. What is his, where is he? Where is he being in prison? Is he at home? Is he in jail? What's the deal?
He's really not at home. He's at a penal colony, one that's, I guess, been described as, and I don't like to use this term softly, but it's been described as almost a concentration camp. And so, I mean, you see in the photo, he doesn't look very well. I can't imagine he's being treated very kindly by the prison guards there. But yeah, he is in one of the harshest penal colonies in Russia, serving out his sentence, which I believe is, you know, about 2 years, and at this point maybe like 6 months. And so he's just kind of sitting there, and you know, I think the whole world is watching what's going to happen to him, because, you know, many opposition politicians and dissidents have died in Russian prisons, or just in Russian jails in holding. And so while Navalny's efforts are still being kind of carried on by his supporters, and including his wife Yulia, This you don't have the face of the Russian opposition, Alexei Navalny, leading it in Russia, and that's damaging.
Yeah, and I mean, it was basically a message. We saw the picture because I think his lawyers had sort of taken a photo of him while he was in prison, and they had passed along the message. And yeah, he does not look great. He does not look good.
Yeah. So I mean, if you look at the Russian media, particularly that of like the more liberal minded and the opposition, they're always talking about Navalny, still trying to keep his efforts alive. But it's hard, right? When you don't have, and you also restrict the ability of civil society organizations in Russia to operate. But I'm sending my best to Navalny as he's sitting in prison. It's terrible.
Yeah, definitely. And now moving on to a big thing that's been happening both domestically and internationally, technically. We have a massive crisis at the border, the U.S.-Mexico border. Many, many migrants have decided to come to the border or crossing the border in those areas that are not cordoned off. And it is chaos right now at the border. I think that's an understatement to say. Many children are being found in the U.S. alone. And immigration's this, for some reason, it's this age-old issue, immigration. And, there are different types of immigration as well, specifically with, the undocumented immigrants, but also with these asylum seekers, most of whom are asylum seekers. I think most of the migrants who are coming to the border, who are surging at the border, are not from Mexico. They're from countries in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, and so on. Many of whom are fleeing, varying conflicts or other sorts of things. And it's a crisis, and it's not just going to be solved in a day. I mean, the last administration promised to build a wall. Where's the? I mean, there's like a half-built wall, and like there's nothing that's been really done to the system to like change the way in which asylum has been processed either. And I think one thing the last administration did was they set up, I think, an agreement with Mexico, right, Ryan, where Mexico would sort of guard their own southern border.
Yeah, I mean, they were playing tough with Mexico just because, I mean, the whole thing with the Trump administration was to build the wall, stymie immigration into the United States, particularly illegal immigration. And so, but of course, the reason why you're seeing the surge is likely because of the softening of immigration policies by the current administration, which, listen, I mean, as the administration said, like the United States is open. They want people to come to the United States. They want them to come legally. They want to make the process simpler. But it's unfortunate when you have children coming, people escaping dire situations, and then they're placed in basically these HHS-run shelters. And they try to accommodate them in a nice manner. But I mean, when you have so many people, it's a very difficult situation. And so
the practicalities of it don't seem very nice when you're looking at it.
Right.
So, I mean, Biden has said like he wants people to come in. But I don't think he necessarily meant this. He said he didn't mean this, but like clearly, like I mean, there was a reduction, I think, in the amount of people who are coming in because they saw Trump as this tough guy who was going to be more so. I don't even know what the accurate word is, but he was tougher in enforcing this stuff. Whether or not it was humane is someone else's debate, but. Biden is seen as a quote unquote a nicer guy. So to the people who are fleeing, they will come in and they will see this as a signal that like, oh, we can come in too.
Well, I mean, this is really just a lose-lose for Biden. I mean, you have the Republicans blaming him for relaxing the policies. You have Democrats getting angry at him for the conditions in the facilities and the separation of children from their parents. And so this is going to be a huge issue and one in which that will test the ability of the administration to act in the first 100 days.
But I mean, it's not a domestic issue by far, because I mean, I think what's going to happen next is the administration is going to have to talk to these governments in Mexico, in Guatemala, in Honduras, in all of these countries that these migrants are coming from to try and figure out like what exactly can like we do to get to the the deep-rooted nature of the problem. Because, yeah, like, we can fix our asylum system, you can have enhanced border security and so on. Like, yeah, those are all, you know, solutions that you could have. But how do you stop the root causes of people fleeing their homes? Like, what is happening in those countries? And how can the U.S. sort of step in to help fix those solutions so we don't have these massive surges?
Well, the President Biden did pledge $4 billion in U.S. aid to Central America to address this very problem. And I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's poverty and crime and also, you know, political instability, that which is, you know, the root cause is, look, when you look at it, it's poverty and crime and corruption. And so, yeah, I mean, it looks like maybe they might throw money at this situation. I don't really anticipate that working, but it's a step.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw Kevin McCarthy's statement at the border.
Oh,
and yes. I don't know how accurate his claims actually were, but he said, we're seeing people from Yemen, Iran, Sri Lanka, Chinese. He said Chinese for some reason, said China. And so, like, that's what's coming across the border. And I was like, wow, you'll have to call me Sri Lanka from now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're a resident Sri Lankan.
Sri Lanka. But I mean, I'd love to see some data on those, like, numbers, if, like, people from Sri Lanka and Iran and China are actually coming in through the southern border. I'd love to see the data.
Do you remember when President Trump said that ISIS was coming in through Mexico?
People are still saying ISIS is coming in through Mexico. Is that actually a thing?
No, it's not a thing. But it's similar in the fact that they're trying to frame this immigration issue as a terrorism issue. And this very, just, it's an incorrect characterization. They're mischaracterizing the reasons for why these people are coming over, and the very people who are coming over, many of whom are seeking asylum because of the situations in their home countries. And so you can have a debate on, you know, the merits of it and illegal immigration, but at the end of the day, right, if you mischaracterize it, you're losing. You're not on the right side.
And I mean, like, look, like, okay, maybe there'll be, like, a few, like, terrorists who might come across the border from the southern border, but you don't think they're going to come in through other ways? Like, we have homegrown terrorism. Many of the attacks that we've seen in the United States have been homegrown.
Yeah, they're not coming in, you know, through our borders and doing it. They're either developing in, as you said, homegrown. I mean, from San Bernardino to, I mean, the Pulse, Boston. I mean, all of these situations. And so, yes, this is a broader conversation. Immigration is certainly an issue that the administration is going to have to deal with. But Andre, we only have a little bit of time left, and there's something I really want to hit on before we wrap up today. And apologies for the sirens in the background, but that's the perks of living across from a hospital. So the National Intelligence Council, which is housed within the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, released a report on March 15th about the foreign threats to the 2020 U.S. federal elections. And there are about four takeaways that I think we should talk about. The first being that there is no indication that a foreign actor attempted to alter voting, right, to get into voting infrastructure and change the results, which is very interesting. Second, that Russia and Vladimir Putin in particular authorized the Russian government, and the Russian government organized influence operations against Biden. So they were anti-Biden influence operations, but no attempt to gain access to infrastructure, which they did try to do in 2016. Thirdly, we have Iran for Biden, right? So we had anti-Trump influence operations by Iran in order to kind of prop up Biden, particularly because of the Iran nuclear deal, right? Iran was struggling significantly under the Trump administration due to sanctions and the withdrawal from the JCPOA. And so they wanted Biden in the White House. And then fourth, China apparently did not deploy any influence operations, but contemplated it, which is the language that this report used. But interestingly, there was a dissent by the National Intelligence Officer for Cyber saying that there was some influence operations. And so that's basically a very quick and dirty version of the report. I suggest everyone go read it. It's interesting. It's not very long. And we'll link it in the episode description.
Certainly. Very, very important, significant developments in that front, but also nothing that would be unexpected or like...
Yeah. We knew all of this, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. That's all I got on my plate as far as what's happening this week. Anything else with you?
No, not really. We have some great episodes that have already come out that are lined up as well. We just released an episode yesterday for all of you listening in on Friday with Washington, D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine. We talk a bit about what happened on January 6th, what his office is doing to address it, whether the president, the former president, is actually under investigation, and so on. And we also have a bit of a conversation on policing in America as well. A great episode with Dr. Ken Dekleva, who is a great expert in leadership analysis. It's called Profiles in Discord. We talk about leadership analysis, and we look at the profiles of Kim Jong-un, Vladimir Putin, and Xi Jinping, and see, you know, what perhaps makes them a quote-unquote good dictator. And yeah, we have some great stuff coming up. We have a great episode, actually, on Monday with Jonna Mendez, former CIA chief of disguise. She is fantastic. A lot of great and fascinating stuff that we all learned. Hopefully you'll listen to it.
I found it incredibly interesting. And for all of you who have not yet seen the movie Argo, watch it. Watch the movie Argo. We talk about it a little bit. It might be a nice preview for the conversation we have. And so thank you all for listening. This has been What in the World. Stay tuned, and we'll see you all next week.